All right. When we use this term universe or many other terms in courts of this kind, the first thing necessary for any real scholarship or progress is to define our terms. Without definition of terms, communication is talking through your dink. And unless the two parties that are involved, or perhaps you and the book, have a mutual standing ground of meaning of terms, all progress is impossible. Now, Brezhnev, the number one man in Soviet Russia, says he believes in democracy. So does candidate Q in Saigon, who is running against nobody but himself in the election coming up there in a few days. And President Nixon says he believes in democracy, and so did our former president, Eisenhower, and so on. Now, I don't think that Brezhnev means the same thing by democracy that we mean by it. Somebody said when Khrushchev, who died a few days ago, was the number one man in Russia, the slogan was, "Vote for Khrushchev, the life you save may be your own." Now, you see, here's a word that's a commonly used word, and yet it's used with different meanings by different people. Mao Zedong, the number one man in communist China, reported yesterday on the radio to be maybe dead. He hadn't been seen or heard from for a while. But anyhow, he wrote a book called The Democratic Dictatorship of the People. The New York Times reviewed it. Anson Baldwin, their foreign affairs writer, reviewed it and said, "Comrade Mao has neglected to inform us what is democratic about a dictatorship, a democratic dictatorship of the people." Now, democratic doesn't mean what we mean by democratic when he said that, and people doesn't either. The people is the members of the Communist Party. And that's not all the people that live in this country, but those that agree with the party line. All right, now, universe. By a dictionary definition, this ought to mean the sum total of existence, all that exists. You see, in it is this word, U-N-I, which is the idea of oneness or totality. Now, from the standpoint of biblical and Christian thought, it is impossible to define, we may not define the universe as the sum total of all that exists. Anybody that has stayed up late last night studying this, want to say why without looking at the book? Why is it improper from the Christian standpoint to define universe as the totality of existence? You know why? All right, why? All right, if you define universe as the totality of all exists, all right, God exists, then God must be a part of the universe. His relation to the universe would be that of a part to the whole. In that case, he cannot have created it. Now, the most basic distinction, not only in the Bible, but in human thought, is that between the creator and the creation. The Bible does not use technical terms very much. It speaks in common language, but in its very first verse, it lays down this most basic of all distinctions, that between the creator and that which is created, the creature of creation. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, in the first place, heaven there doesn't mean where you go when you die. This means outer space in that verse. So let's say the physical universe, including the earth. In the beginning, God, that's one side of the Grand Canyon here. The other side, that which he created, which means to make it out of nothing, the heaven and the earth, or the physical universe, including this earth. Now, that distinction is never violated in the Bible. This goes right on through. It's assumed at every point, clear down through to the end of the New Testament. And any system that tends to obscure this or to break it down or in any way to think of God as himself a part of the universe is destructive of the whole system of Christian truth. Now then, this is true in human thought as well as in the Bible. You can give many distinctions, of course, like that between an A and a B and so on, but The most basic of all distinctions is that between the self-existent God on the one hand and that which is he has created on the other. Now, I will not ask you to learn by heart very much in this course outside of the Ten Commandments, just a couple, three things. And it's necessary to have two or three definitions pretty well in mind to keep from getting lost. And here's one of them, theism. Now, this comes from the Greek word for God, theos, which means God. And the ISM on it means a belief or a system, a structure of thinking. Theism, or belief in God. Now, theism, however, is a particular kind of belief in God. You see, almost anybody claims to believe in God these days. There are very few who will stick their neck out and say they're an atheist, although there are some. But most people, at least in the Western world, claim to believe in God. However, what they mean by this may not be what the Bible means by it or what Christian thinking means by it. And somebody says, well, I think of God as a great cosmic force like gravity or, let's say, nuclear energy or something like this. And they're thinking of God. And while they say they believe in God, they mean something different by this from what the Christian system of truth holds it means. Now, in this definition, theism is the truth that there is a personal, almighty God, creator and ruler of all things, who is distinct from the universe. And this, I should say, is important, and This has come up on test quizzes or exams occasionally in the past, and it might in the future. Now, so I think that's worth saying. That's the definition reduced to its lowest possible terms. You cannot leave anything out of that without fatal damage to the idea that is intended to be conveyed. The truth or belief that there is a personal, almighty God, creator and ruler of all things, who is distinct from the universe. Now, the language of that is simple. The ideas, however, are not simple, and let me tell you, that bristles with problems and difficulties, and it's necessary to face them a little bit. The first thing about that is it says that God is a person. And you think you know what this means. You know, personality. Everybody has an idea what this means, and yet it's very hard to define in words. It's like falling in love. If you've ever done it, you know what it feels like. But wonderful, too. But how do you define this in words? You say, I love you. Is that a definition of falling in love? That's absolutely inadequate. Well, personality. The hitch here is, the trouble is, that this is used in a popular sense, very commonly today, and then also in a technical or psychological sense, is what we're dealing with here. A girl in high school said about one of her teachers, she has absolutely no personality. Now, I wonder, is that a compliment? Not exactly, all right. Are there high school teachers of either sex that have absolutely no personality? Miss McConaughey, you think there are? There aren't. All right. Any high school teacher that isn't an absolute idiot has personality of some kind, maybe a perfectly horrid personality. What did the young lady mean when she said this teacher had absolutely no personality? What do you think she meant? Well, I'll talk at once here now. Yeah, all right, what do you think you meant?
Rotten
personality. All right, that's very expressive. Yeah, I don't like her, see? She's an old meanie. I don't like her. So she has no personality. And you think of personality, somebody that's a very popular movie star or something like this has a lot of personality, see? And of course, all the Geneva faculty do. But anyway, Now, this is not the sense that we use when we're speaking of it in a connection like this, say God is a personal being. This means there's a distinction between persons and what are not persons or things. Personality we humans have. Everybody above the idiot level has it. That includes the entire student body. We have personality as distinguished from things. This wristwatch of mine or this watch has no personality, neither does the tape recorder. It's a thing. It's an object. But we humans have personality. Now then, what do you mean by it? In addition to the fact that it distinguishes us from that which is impersonal. There was a fellow in here one year that sat over there near the door. I don't remember his name. I don't know where he sat and argued that his dog had more personality than many Geneva students. And to the amusement of the class, I argued the contrary. So we debated it out. And I said, look here, fella, I like dogs too. But let me tell you, your dog has absolutely no personality. The traits on account of which you say your dog has more personality than many Geneva students, it has picked up as habits from associating with people. If you would find a coyote or a timber wolf genetically identical or virtually so with the domestic dog, they interbreed without any hitch at all, you would find it, or one of the scavenger dogs of an oriental city, that are the city's garbage collection system, and just as soon bite your hand off as not, you would find this mutt completely lacking in those lovable and adorable traits on account of which the dog is called man's best friend. Now look, a dog that has a home and that has an owner or a master is a man worshiper. A dog looks up at a man with a soulful look in his eyes that says, as effectively as words could say it, "Old guy, I like you. I believe in you. Your wife is down on you, but I like you." And so a dog is said to have personality. Now, a dog does not, admittedly on the borderline, but what it has picked up from associating with people. No animal really has personality, although some have some traits that seem to be a sort of a faint copy of it. Yes, you have a question?
Do you believe that a person is born with personality?
They're born with a potential personality, a latent potential for personality, just like they're born with a potential to be 5 feet tall or whatever and to have a mind that can reach a certain IQ. But it isn't developed when they're born. A newborn baby has only a latent or potential personality. And this is, of course, important in itself, but it's just like a seed or a plant or a seedling tree. The nature of the tree is in it, but it still has to grow up. That makes sense? All right. Now then, no animal really has personality. The chicken is one of the dumbest of all large creatures, as the dog is one of the smartest. I strongly advise you to not steal chickens, but if you ever do, animal psychology has researched this. The chicken's memory lasts 2 weeks, no more. If you steal chickens, shut them up 2 weeks, and they're yours forever. They'll come home to roost to your place, not to where you took them away from. So this is, a chicken will go, it'll get out of the chicken yard through a hole in the fence and get into a flower bed and scratch things up all day long. And when it begins to get dark, wants to get back in there where it can roost for the night where the other chickens are, and will walk back and forth past that hole in the fence 1,000 times, more or less, and can't figure out how to get back in that chicken yard. You see, this is certainly not personality. But anyway, we have personality, and God has it. This is the thing that marks us as similar to God and different from the entire subhuman existence or creation, all animals. This marks us off. This is a dividing line. There's the line between creator and creature, and then secondly, and if you've read the Schaefer's little book on ecology, you're really up on this, the line between the personal and the impersonal. And man, along with God, has the personal. And everything else is below that line and does not have personality. Now, this includes a number of distinguishable ideas. One is consciousness. This, we know what it is. It's also hard to define, but it's a subjective awareness of our surroundings. A plant has no consciousness. an animal has a degree of consciousness, but man has self-consciousness. We are not only aware of the world outside of us, but aware of ourselves and what's inside of us, and can think about ourselves as thinkers. Now, a cow has consciousness. It can, dim bovine variety of it, it can get over to the fence and look across to the next field and, in a dim-witted bovine way, figure out the grass is greener over there. I kind of wish I was on that side. This is certainly consciousness. But there's no cow that has self-consciousness. You ever hear of a cow sitting down under a tree and saying, now let's take an inventory of personality. What kind of a cow am I, extroverted or introverted? Well, of course, it won't. And furthermore, when a cow takes that last truck ride to the place where it's going to be translated into hamburgers, it does this without fear, without apprehension of the future, without anxiety. It lives in the present moment and cannot project its thinking and its fears into the future. Maybe this is better for the cow than if it could worry for years about what is my latter end going to be like. Will it be at Swift & Company or at Armored? But at any rate, a cow has no self-consciousness, and we have self-consciousness. We are aware not only of reality outside of us, but of ourselves as the observer of reality. You see, this is part of what personality means. Now another thing is a moral sense. The distinction between right and wrong is meaningful to us. And it's meaningful to us because it is meaningful to God. No animal has a conscience. Animals have instincts, but not conscience. A dog that has been spanked or swatted for something that displeases its master will put its tail between its legs and go hide under the table somewhere. It will also do this if it thinks that a bath is in the near future. Not that the dog feels guilty, but it prefers not to be swatted again, that's all. And we have a moral sense of right and wrong. This distinction is meaningful to us. This is a part of personality that is copied after God and is different from the animal world. Now, memory, the power of rational thinking. I was telling you about the fellow that said his dog had personality. Here was another a man that boasted to a neighbor that his horse had personality. He said, I got that horse of mine trained. He can go down the lane 300 yards to the highway and open the RFC mailbox and pick up the morning newspaper in his teeth and bring it up to the house. Now, isn't that pretty good? And the neighbor said, yeah, it's pretty good for a horse. But did you ever hear of anybody boasting that he had his 10-year-old son trained to the point where, why, that boy of mine is only 10 years old and I got him trained. He can go down the lane and pick up the morning paper and bring it back to the house. Now, if anybody started bragging that way about his 10-year-old son, you'd wonder, what is this 10-year-old son, an absolute imbecile or what, that he has to be trained to pick up the newspaper? You see, you expect it of a boy or girl, but you don't expect it of a horse. The horse does not really have personality. It can be trained to do some tricks, but the human has personality. All right, what's yours?
Is it instinct to make an animal travel like 1,000 miles
to come back to the Well, this is highly mysterious. I think it's instinct to homing pigeons. You can read what the experts have written about this. It seems to go by sort of a sixth sense awareness of the Earth's magnetic field or something like this. I don't know. I don't think this is fully understood. Yeah, this is instinct. Yeah. Well, there's a famous story about the amazing journey about a dog and a cat that found their way home across Canada. I think it's fiction. But anyway, birds that have never seen a nest or seen eggs or anything know how to build a nest and lay eggs and sit on them till they hatch and look after the little fledglings that hatch out of those eggs. Where did they learn this? They didn't take animal biology to Geneva to learn it. They just know this. And each kind of bird makes its own kind of nest without anybody teaching them how either. So this is instinct that is sort of built in to the animal. But now you see, people have the capacity for rational thinking. I mean, normal people do. You can think. You can put two and two together and draw conclusions. You can reason. Or you can follow somebody else's argument and see whether it's valid or invalid. Get Aristotle out of the library and read of this ancient stuff, you know, Father of Science and philosophy. Yeah, it rings a bell. I see what the old boy's talking about. Because your mind, like Aristotle's mind, you're not Aristotle, but your mind, like Aristotle's mind, has the power of rational thinking. Now, you try explaining Aristotle to your dog or your horse, and it won't work. All right, now this is part of what we mean by personality, that we have and God has and the animal doesn't have. Now, another thing about this is the relation of God to space and time. God is self-existent, never had an origin, and is independent of space and time, unlike ourselves in this respect. Dr. Matson Bose, former head of the history department, he went overseas this year, had a little sign tacked out on the door of his office that said, "Why study history? There's no future in it." That was just a gag, of course, no future in history. But we have a history. We are caught in the fabric of space and time, if you please, the space-time continuum. This is where we belong. And we can't get out of this, in this life anyway, any more than a catfish down here in the river can flip out and say, "I'm going to Geneva to go to college." It can't be done. Life is in the water. Now then, God exists of himself. And this is something that will baffle you, not only in this course, but I don't think they count time in heaven in years, but if they do, when you've been there a few billion, this is still going to baffle you. A little girl went to Sunday school and came home and said to her mother, "Mama, I learned today that God made everything. Now I want to know who made God." What do you tell a kid that says something like that? Well, professors, when they're stumped, say that's a good question. Who made God? Suppose the mother had said to her, "Well, Susie, there was a powerful being named X. He made God." "Okay, Mama, who made X?" "Well, there was a super powerful being named Y. He made X." "Mama, who made Y?" "There was a super, super powerful being named Z. He made Y." "Okay, Mama, who made Z?" Now, you see, this goes on farther than there are letters in the alphabet to do it by. There's no end of it. Here's a chain, each link of which would be hung on the link above, and there's nothing to hang the top link on. Aristotle again said there must be an original, unmoved mover. This isn't exactly the Christian idea of God, but it has a relationship to it. Now, we had an origin. Where were you 100 years ago? I guess there's nobody here over 100. I'm approaching it, but nobody here over 100. I'm 68. Where were you 100 years ago? Well, you were a thought in the mind of God and a genetic potentiality in the germplasm of your great-grandparents 100 years ago, that's all. You had no real existence as the person you are 100 years ago. And you had an origin. Everybody has two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, 16 great-great-grandparents, and so on. And this has been going on since there have been people in the world. And we are so built that we have to think everything has an origin, even the physical universe. The most plausibly held cosmic theory is the Big Bang theory, that the universe is expanding, everything is at a terrific rate, getting farther and farther apart. This, figured backwards, this implies everything was once closer together than it is now, and that cannot have been going on forever. If everything is progressively getting farther apart, there must have been a time when it was so close together that it couldn't have been any closer, and that implies a beginning, you see. Now then, this is the way we are geared to think. You can't think any other way. And therefore, the idea of a being who never had an origin is inherently baffling to us. Now, you can learn Christian truth about God, but you can never explain God. And if you could, he wouldn't be worth believing in. This is part of religion. This is the mystery that surrounds the idea of God. A God that would be completely clear and transparent and explainable to us would not really be God, to be spelled with a capital G. He'd be a kind of a Superman. Now, the relation of God to time. St. Augustine, one of the great thinkers of Christian history, and you'll hear me quoting him from time to time in this class, he was an all-out hippie for several years. And his mother prayed for him for 31 years before he was converted to be a Christian. She went to a bishop in northern Africa and said, "Bishop, would you reason with my son? He's going to the devil." And this bishop said, "No, I will not reason with your son. I've had dealings with young men before. This is how you make them stubborn." She started to cry tears. And the bishop said, "Go your way. Pray on. It is impossible for the son of such prayers and of such tears to perish." And she prayed for him 31 years. Now, and he was converted to be a Christian in Milan, Italy, where they make adding machines today. But anyway, Augustine wrote the history of his life and conversion in a book called His Confession. And it's quite a story, too. But in the latter part of this, he has some philosophical thought. And he grapples with the question of the relation of God to time. Now, Augustine was a great Christian and a great thinker, but if there's anything this man lacked, it was a sense of humor. He was absolutely dead serious about everything. He couldn't see anything funny in anything. And he says that he heard somebody ask the question, "What was God doing before he made the world?" And Augustine said, "Now I'll tell you how I heard this answered. You understand, I'm not endorsing this answer, I'm only reporting it. What was God doing before he made the world?" And somebody answered it by saying he was getting hell ready as a place to put people who ask too many questions. And then he said, "This is an unworthy answer. It was a serious question asked in good faith and should have had a serious answer, and therefore I will undertake to answer it." This is followed by about 5 pages of the heaviest reading you ever saw. And finally, he comes up with this. "This cannot be answered because the question itself doesn't mean anything. When you say before or after, you have already assumed that the being you are talking about exists within the framework of space and time, what we would call the space-time continuum. You have already assumed it when you say before or after. This is not true of God. Before or after is not meaningful to God except in relation to his creatures, not to God in himself. Therefore, this question is meaningless." Now, God, therefore, unlike ourselves, exists independently of time and, we might say, independently of space. I was quoted a couple years ago in the cabinet as having said, "Our immediate environment is our underwear." Is in a column, quotes from the faculty. "Our immediate environment is our underwear." Now, that isn't all I said. They only quoted part of it. So we humans have an environment. There's yourself, and it stops with your skin. Beyond that, your underwear, then a series of concentric circles or onion rings. The next is your overwear, including your wig if you wear one. And then after that, the place you are sitting or standing, this room, Geneva College, Pennsylvania, the United States, the Western Hemisphere, the Earth, the solar system, the physical universe, and far out beyond the farthest spiral galaxy, the utmost limit of Einsteinian curved space. And when you've got there, that still isn't your ultimate environment. It starts with your underwear, but it doesn't stop with Einstein's curved space. The ultimate is in a different dimension, and it is God who himself is independent of these things. You got a question?
Yeah, all right. Explain the idea of sequence in the acting world. Is the acting world not
so much in time? Sequence. Well, this is God speaks of this. For instance, the angels in heaven do things one after another. The relation of the spiritual, what will it be like in heaven? You going to take your wristwatch to heaven? Well, I don't think you are, but you see, in this life we are absolutely geared to time. You can't get away from it. Surely, as we are not God, we are created beings, there must be something similar to time in eternity. And this must affect the angels and other spiritual beings. Exactly what this is, though, nobody knows. And one thing is for sure, when a person departs from this present physical life, calendars, watches, and clocks lose their relevance. Now, there must be something similar to this. Only God is truly independent of time, you see. So there must be something to take the place of this. C.S. Lewis thought in one of his books that we will be masters and not slaves of time, that we will be able to sort of like, if you ever read this comic, I don't know whether you have or not, comic strip of Alioub, who has a time machine. He can journey back and forth. He can go back to the French Revolution and so forth and sort of voyage around in time. Well, this is a speculative idea, but it could be, of course. And one thing that Einstein has taught us is that both space and time and motion are relative. These are relative to each other and not the absolutes that we once thought they were. There was a film shown by the Christian Student Fellowship once of the Moody Science Institute that showed a football game in rapid motion. You sat there and watched this empty stadium fill up with people and an entire game, four quarters played, and everybody found out again, leaving it empty, and the total time on the screen this took was about 3 minutes. And speeded up like that. And theoretically, if you could get to going fast enough, you would get younger as you go along. Please don't try it. I fear for the results. All right, now then, you see, you have a birthday. You're a year older every year. Does God have birthdays? Is God a year older than he was when last year's class was at this point in the course? Well, certainly not, you see. God isn't getting older. We get older. So God exists in this way independently of time. Now there are two correlative ideas about God that have to be taken together to avoid a distorted idea of God. His transcendence and his immanence. I-M-M-A-N, not I-N. I-M-M-A-N-E-N-C-E. This means his being in everything. The transcendence of God is his out beyondness. And the immanence of God is his right in here-ness. To manufacture a couple of words. Now, these are correlative terms. I attended a parent teacher association meeting once. These I consider pretty dull affairs usually, but this one was a stunt night, and the parents were putting on the stunt, not the teachers. And two men, who were parents of kids in that school, put on a gag or a skit. They had a debate on this topic, resolved that married men make the best husbands. Now, obviously, it was only intended for a gag, but nobody but married men are husbands, and husbands are always married men. Husband and wife are correlative terms. There isn't such a thing as a husband without a wife or a wife without a husband. Parent and child are correlative terms. There's no such thing as a parent that doesn't have or hasn't had children, and no such thing as a child that either doesn't have or hasn't had parents. So you have to take these two together to get the whole idea. Now, the out beyondness of God, or his transcendence, by which we say he's prior to everything in a different dimension, out beyond everything and so forth, over against the immanence, you say God is everywhere. He's in the proton and the neutron and the neutrino and all these subatomic particles. Sometimes called the cosmic presence of God. The ultimate energy of the universe is from the presence of God in it. But he's also out beyond it. And these two are parallel. And any tendency to hold one without the other leads you away from the biblical and Christian idea of God. Now then, the Trinity, the three oneness of God, is a concept far beyond the scope of this course to take up in any depth. Basic to Christianity, but I will spend a little time on it here. Incidentally, we take one assignment a day as programmed, except there's one time there where we have to take two in one day, blame us on the administration. But apart from that, one a day, and if we don't finish it in class, this is a compliment to your academic maturity and a challenge to you to bone it up yourself out of the book. And we start the next time on the next assignment, not on what's left of today, unless some student brings up something. For instance, Tuesday, we'll take up assignment two, If somebody wants to bring up something in assignment one and get further discussion of it or explanation of it, okay, I'll discuss it further. But otherwise, one a day, and what we don't finish, that's your privilege to bone up by yourself from this syllabus or other sources. And this way, we never get behind schedule. Always right up to schedule and finish on the dot. Now then, the Trinity. God is three and God is one. This is basic to Christianity, one God in three persons. First of all, the term persons here is an English word which is very inadequate to convey the idea. The Greek word hypostasis does not mean exactly what we mean by person. But for want of a different, better word, this is what we have to use. Now then, Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Scoffers and unbelievers accuse us Christians of believing a contradiction. They say, look here, you Christians say God is one, then you turn right around and say God is three, and that's a contradiction. Now, I will try to get you to see this is a mystery. It is even a paradox, but it is beyond reason to solve, but it is not a contradiction. Can you believe a contradiction, really now? Well, I asked a student once, can you believe that God could make a square triangle? He said, yes. I said, oh, come on now. He said, yes, God is almighty. This would take an awful lot of power, but God could do it. Another fellow said that yesterday, too. And then I said, all right, you see this classroom door? It's wide open, isn't it? Do you think God could fix things up so that that door would be wide open and shut tight at the same time? Yeah, he believed this, too. And if you believe God is almighty, you have to believe God could have that door wide open and shut tight at the same time. And I said, fiddle-dee-dee. He could not. There's one thing God can't do according to the Bible. He can't deny himself. God can't write out a paper and say, I resign as God. I'm going to quit being God. And to be God is to be reasonable, to go by reason, is part of God's being or nature. He can't make a square triangle. The universe would flip out in no time. This is something even God can't do. Now, you see, God can do everything in the sphere of power. But this isn't in the sphere of power. This is in the sphere of reason. You might just as well say you could build a diesel engine powerful enough to draw an inference as to say that God could create a square triangle. This is not in the sphere of power. It's in the sphere of reason. All right. Now, if we would say God is one and God is not one, that would be a contradiction, and you couldn't believe it without going nuts. Be ready for the men with the little white coat. Or if we would say God is three and God is not three, that also would be a contradiction. Or if we would say God is one and God is three in the same sense that he's one, this would be a contradiction, and nobody could believe it. And anybody say they believe that, they're just talking words without thinking. But this is not what the historic Christian and church doctrine of the Trinity, affirmed by the great councils long ago, holds. God is one in one sense, he is three in a different sense. God is one, if you please, to put it in very simple language, in his basic core of existence. There's only one God. This is the background of the Trinity. Only one God, monotheism. And he is three in his centers of consciousness. Now, this is mysterious, but it isn't a contradiction, because we're not saying he's three in the same sense that he's one. There's a faint illustration of this in abnormal psychology, often cited in psych textbooks, of the split personality or schizophrenia. There was a famous case of this, of a young lady that had three personalities. Talk about having personalities. She had three of them. And three different names and three different phases. And she would, I forget the names, whether she was Jane and Sally and somebody else, but she would have a little sort of a mental click and snap from one into the other. In the first phase, she was a cigarette fiend who chain-smoked cigarettes and couldn't live without them. Thought she could. And in the second phase, she couldn't stand tobacco and would hide the cigarettes. And when she snapped back to the first phase, she couldn't find out where they were hidden. And the third phase, a very gloomy, depressed and pessimistic sort of personality. And the psychiatrists worked on her. They had to decide which of these three was the most worthy of being retained and perpetuated, and they did. I forget how they decided this, but they finally got her over the other two and got her sort of unified. Now, this is not really parallel to the Trinity, because God is, he doesn't shift from one into the other. He is simultaneously, you see, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, but these are three centers of activity and consciousness in the one being of God. Now, don't let any scoffer or unbeliever in Christianity tell you it's a contradiction. You admit that it's a paradox or that it involves a mystery, and this is just because it's about God. Of course, you don't expect to understand God like you'd understand a problem in, let's say, in geometry and say, QED, I got it figured out. God is bound to remain mysterious to us. Now, it's not a contradiction, and don't let anybody try to push you around by saying that it is. If you get into two hot water arguments, send them to me. I'll tell them some things. Now, we'll take up a few of the deviant ideas of God, and we haven't got time for them all. But first of all, atheism. I wonder, atheism is the denial that God exists. Are there very many real atheists, do you think? Well, there's people who say they're atheists. I may tell you, you ought to be sorry for an atheist. It's awfully hard to be a good atheist, just like it's awfully hard to be a good devil. A good devil is a bad devil. But anyhow, the atheist is fighting not only against the whole testimony of most of humanity and the world of nature that witnesses to God, but he's fighting against something inside of himself. Now, this is only a joke, but I heard this it illustrates this. A Christian was trying to witness to an atheist and get him converted if possible. And he was talking to him, you know. And maybe the best way of witnessing is not to talk too much. But anyhow, he was trying to persuade this atheist. And the atheist wasn't buying it. And finally he got resentful about it and sort of blew up. Religion, mister! Don't you talk to me about religion. Sir, I'll have you understand, sir. I'm an atheist, thank God. Now, you know what that is? That's a Freudian slip. The idea of God was in his subconscious, but ordinarily it wouldn't come out. People that see belief in God includes a moral obligation to do right and avoid wrong. And well, like my kid brother, my father called him down at the dinner table for using some distinctly strong language and said, nice people don't talk like that. Dad, you forget. I'm not nice. I'm horrid. Now, you see, belief in God is not an abstract idea like believing in, let's say, relativity or something. Belief in God carries with it every time a moral obligation. And if you have violated this, you feel guilty. This is distinctly uncomfortable to confront God that way. And so the atheist has tried to bury this. But it's still there. You can't get rid of it. Not completely. Now, you know, a Freudian slip, Sigmund Freud. You don't have to be a Freudian to learn some things from that lady. Here's a man says to his wife, I'd like to kiss you. That's what he thinks he's going to say. But what he says is, I'd like to kick you. Or maybe I'd like to kill you. This is a thought that was way down in his subconscious. And when he thought he was going to say, I'd like to kiss you, he said, I'd like to kick you. I heard a minister say, Christians don't swear, except when they hit their thumb with a hammer. You see, the cuss word's in there all right. But ordinarily, your moral censorship won't allow you to use that kind of language. But when you hit your thumb with a hammer, the cuss word comes out before the censorship can snap shut. So you say something that, well, no Geneva student ought to say. All right, now, the atheist is fighting against what is built into his own personality. Eddie Rickenbacker was a famous player. Did he die? I think he died not too long ago, but in two world wars. Rickenbacker was born in a Christian family in Seattle, I believe. Maybe it was Portland, in the Northwest. His mother was a godly praying woman, member of the Free Methodist Church. And Rickenbacker reacted against this and became a godless person. And for many years of his adult life, lived without, as far as anybody could see, taking any notice of God or any serious thought of God. In World War II, his plane engine failed and he had to bail out over the Pacific. And here he was in a life raft, a rubber life raft, with two other men, three of them, out on the far Pacific somewhere. Now, I've been across it four times by ship, and let me tell you, there's an awful lot of water there. Some places it's 7 miles deep. And here they were in a rubber raft with water everywhere, but not a drop that anybody could drink. Drink that seawater, and it makes you thirstier than you were before, and it'll even kill you. So they were in a desperate situation, and faced with agonizing death from hunger, but especially from thirst. Sun beating down on them, and no water. And finally, Rickenbacker said, "I'll try to pray." He hadn't prayed for years and years. And you know, those three fellows didn't even know how it is customary to speak to God in prayer. They called God the old man upstairs, not meaning anything irreverent by this either. They just didn't know. Rickenbacker prayed that God would have mercy on them and spare their life. You think he had a motive for praying? Well, sure. And after a while, it began to rain. And they got some water, some drinkable water. They didn't get enough to satisfy their thirst, but they got enough to save their life. And then one of them caught a fish. Now, raw fish is not a smorgasbord delicatessen item, except in Japan, where they favor it. But they bust this raw fish up into three parts and ate it ravenously. And later they caught one more raw fish. And finally they were rescued. And Rickenbacker, after years of forgetting God, came back to the faith of his childhood. Now you see, belief in God was there. Another illustration, and this will be true. There was a cruise ship years ago, the Morro Castle. Before World War II, going from New York to the West Indies, and loaded with people. I'm afraid they had many more people than they had room for in the lifeboats. But they were having a good time, you know, dancing and drinking cocktails and playing cards and just generally enjoying themselves. And this ship hit a mine that was adrift and left over from World War I. And it exploded and tore a big hole in the side of the ship, and the ship began to sink. Only a fraction of those people were rescued by lifeboats or survived. And those people who had been living quite obviously without regard to God, many of them, by the testimony of the survivors, tried to pray. Kneel down by a sofa or a davenport or chair or something and try to pray. Now you see, the belief in God is there, but it can be suppressed, but under enough pressure, it will come to the surface again. So atheism is, the Bible calls it the religion of the fool. Psalm 14, verse 1. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Why is this true? Why is it just a fool? You can be a heretic without being a fool. But a fool who denies something built into himself, you see, as well as something outside of him and round about. Now, the rest of this, these deviant ideas of God, I commend to you not to believe in them, but to study out and figure out what they are. And we'll stop here at this point.